most loving pranams at Bhagwan's Lotus Feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, The Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and it's my pleasure to join you all from our studios at the Sri Sathya Sai Media Center. In this program, we go through the Bhagavad Gita verse by verse, and I've had the pleasure of your company for well over a year, close to 2 years it's going to be, and I'm extremely grateful for that. And in the course of this journey, we've covered 6 chapters of the Bhagavad Gita. We just began the 7th chapter a couple of weeks back. As we've been talking about how the chapters have been distributed, it is from this point that Lord Krishna begins to speak about the nature of Brahman, the nature of divinity itself. If you were to do a study of the various philosophies and various religions that we see around the world, much of the difference or much of the uniqueness of each of these pathways to God is how they choose to describe God and how they describe this relationship between God and creation. So this part is very important in that sense that it defines what Sanatan Dharma stands for through these definitions of divinity and our relationship with divinity. What is our role in creation? What is our place in creation? Of course, it is not that this is the first time this topic is being discussed, even in the Bhagavad Gita. But specifically, this is taken as a matter of study, starting from the 7th chapter. And we're going to see a couple of verses today, we're going to see a couple of verses next week and the week after that, which are all going to speak about this very profound definition of who's divine, who's God, and what is our relationship with this divinity. Let's begin with a short summary of what we covered last time. We covered 3 verses last time. Hopefully we'll be able to cover 3 more today. We covered verses 3, 4 and 5 of the 7th chapter. The first 3 verses of the chapter itself are preparatory in nature, and we've seen how Krishna has been drawing Arjuna's attention by telling how rare this knowledge is, which he is going to talk about. Right? So the first 3 as well as one of the shlokas, the last shloka of the previous chapter, were suggestive of Arjuna, pay attention, because what I'm going to say is very important, and it is likely that you're not going to find this in any other text or from any other spiritual master. So the 3rd verse that we saw last week is in line with that, in which Krishna says, of the thousands of people who live in this world a regular worldly life, one random person turns to the path of yoga, turns to the path of divinity. And of the thousands who take to the path of divinity, one actually knows me truly. Mam veti tattvataha. One random person knows me in my true essence, in my true tattva. So the idea is, Krishna says, you have to listen to what I'm saying. This is a very important exposition of jnana and vijnana. And even as an individual who is in the place of about to receive this knowledge, understand that this point that you've reached has come after thousands and thousands of births of being a worldly person, and probably thousands of births of trying to be a spiritual aspirant. And today you are in a position to listen to this discourse right from the source of all knowledge. So you're very lucky. This opportunity of you standing here and receiving this discourse is an immense grace that is being showered on you. So pay attention and listen to what I'm saying keenly. So that is the temper and the flavor of those first 3 shlokas. In the next 2 shlokas, shlokas 4 and 5, Krishna introduces the concept of the 2 prakritis, apara and para. And we discussed extensively about these 2. We'll continue to discuss even this week. In the 4th shloka, he speaks first about apara prakriti, which is, he says, ashtada or eightfold. And the eight components of that prakriti being the five elements, as we know them, and manas, buddhi, and ahankara, the mind, the intellect, and the ego sense. In the fifth shloka, Krishna says that this eightfold expression is only apara, which means it is normal. It is ordinary. But there is another prakriti of mine which is para, which is supreme, which is beyond this worldliness. And that has become this jivatma, and it has entered this apara prakriti, and that is what holds this entire creation together. It becomes the adhara or the foundation for all this to be together. And this concept is very beautifully going to be explained even in one of the verses that we are going to cover today. So these two verses, 4 and 5, and where he introduces this concept of para prakriti and apara prakriti. And we of course went to the Gita Vahini and we read about what Swami says there. And Swami uses two other terminology, and this is consistently used by many people who write commentaries and discourses on the Bhagavad Gita. The apara prakriti, or the ordinary nature of the Lord, is referred to as swabhava, and the para prakriti, which is the true nature of the Lord, is referred to as swarupa. And Swami also uses these two words when he is explaining this portion of the Bhagavad Gita. So those are the three verses that we covered last time. The discourse on para and apara prakriti continue. We listen to verse number 6 of the 7th chapter. As always, we listen to it in the clear rendition of Brother Shyam. After that, I'll give you a brief meaning of this verse, and then we will discuss deeply about this very beautiful and important verse from the 7th chapter.
Etadyonini bhutani sarvani tyupadharaya aham krishnasya jagatah prabhavah pralayastatha.
Understand thus that all things have these as their source. I am the origin as also the end of the whole universe. So that is the 6th verse of the 7th chapter. As I just mentioned, Krishna continues his discourse on the two prakritis. And if you ask me, these are likely to lead to a few confusions. The idea of two prakritis, God, two prakritis, and then creation, then you and me, where do we all fit into all this? Well, at least to me, there appear to be some issues. I will not claim that I will resolve all those questions that arise, and I will be able to give a comprehensive and very convincing explanation for what Krishna is speaking here. I think I'll need much, much more mananam and nididhyasanam before I'm able to do that. But I'm here as a representative of all you listeners. Along with all of you, I'm also reading the Bhagavad Gita, and I'm only trying to share what Swami has spoken about this and what little we've gathered about all what Krishna is saying through Swami's discourses and, of course, the other writings of everybody. So I'm just giving that as a precursor, that don't expect the most comprehensive explanation from me. But nevertheless, there are some things that we might, that might occur to us as not very clear. We will try to understand that. But what we must keep in mind, even as we are reading about these very profound and very deep insights into creation, is that the whole idea of spirituality, as per the approach of Vedanta, what Bhagavad Gita is actually the essence, is to realize that we are not the wave, we are the ocean. Is to understand that we are not the part, but we are essentially the whole. So this goal has been very clearly stated to us, and this has to be kept in mind even as we go through these explanations. Having that in mind, let us see what Krishna is saying here. After stating that there are two prakritis, Krishna makes it very clear that everything in creation has come only from these two. He says, Bhutani Sarvani, all beings here. The word Bhutani, in fact, covers even non-sentient beings, because the Bhuta, the root of that word Bhutani, or the singular of that Bhutani, the word Bhuta also stands for elements, right? That's why we use the term Pancha Bhutas, for the five elements. So Bhuta stands not only for living beings, because Bhuta, the word itself, also stands for anything that exists. So Bhutani means all that exists. That's why in the previous verse, Krishna specifically mentions Jiva Bhutam when he's talking about the Paraprakriti. Because Jiva Bhutam means he's specifically referring to living beings, and living beings are infused with the soul as Jivatma, right? So Bhuta also means insentient. So Bhutani Sarvani, when Krishna says, all that is, all that exists, Yetad Yonini, have these two as their source. Iti, thus, Upadharaya, understand. Yetat Yonini. The word Yoni means womb or source. So Yonini means that which is born of something, right? So Krishna is saying, Yetat Yonini, Bhutani Sarvani, means everything that is, everything that exists, is born of these two. Which two? Which he mentioned in the previous two verses, Para and Apara Prakriti. Not only are they born, they also dissolve into it. And Krishna makes that very clear in the very next line. He says, Aham, I am, Kritsnasya Jagataha, of the entire Jagat, Prabhavaha, source, Pralayaha Tatha, the dissolution too. We discussed this concept of something that is same in the beginning and the end, and is briefly separate in the middle, can well be considered as not being separate at all. That separateness is non-existent. To refresh your memory, I think it was in the 28th verse of the second chapter that Krishna speaks about that, where the verse goes, Avyaktadini bhutani vyakta madhyani bharata avyakta nidananyeva tatraka paridevana. Avyakta adini, that which is unmanifest in the beginning, Bhutani, those beings, Vyakta Madhyani Bharata, they come into existence in the middle. The word Vyakta means individual. It also means manifest. So when Krishna says Avyakta Adini, it was unmanifest in the beginning, it becomes Vyakta in the middle, Vyakta Madhyani. It manifests and seems to have individuality in between. Vyakta Madhyani. Avyakta Nidhanani. It becomes avyakta or unmanifest in the end. And when we are going through the shloka at that point, I had said this, how Swami explains in one of his discourses, that which is unmanifest in the beginning and unmanifest in the end can be spoken of always being unmanifest, or when it manifests, that manifestation can be considered as being an illusion. And here Krishna elaborates that everything begins from him and everything also ends in him. Aham Kritsnasya Jagataha Prabhavaha Pralayaha Tata. Prabhavaha, I am the source. Pralayaha Tata, I am also the destination. You can see this through two analogies, right? And as I always say whenever I'm using analogies, no analogy can ever be comprehensive in describing these spiritual truths. It will convey a specific idea, that's all. That's all it can do. So I will use two analogies which convey a certain idea, but which are also limited in a certain sense. So in that way, these two analogies tend to complement each other, and together they probably convey the idea of the shloka. The first is that of a mother and her child. Krishna also uses the word yoni, which often is used in relation to a mother and a child. We are all referred to as yonija, a word which is used in Sanskrit. Yonija means we are born through a mother, we are born through a womb. A person who is not born through the normal means of conception, is not brought to this earth through a mother's womb, is referred to as ayonija. If you look at our scriptures, if you look at even Mahabharata, Draupadi and Drishtadyumna, who were born from the sacrificial fire, they are referred to in the Mahabharata as ayonija. Similarly, Mother Sita, who has been found in a crater in the earth, she's supposed to be the daughter of Mother Earth, right? So she is also referred to as ayonija. She's not born out of a mother, ayonija janma. Of course, the analogy that I'm going to give is not exactly what Krishna is mentioning in this particular shloka, but it conveys an idea, as I just said. It conveys a certain idea, but it does not convey the complete picture. When a mother gives birth to a child, what actually happens is a part of her becomes a new entity, right? It is actually nothing but a part of her which grows, acquires a life of its own, and eventually is born, and is born to an individual status. And when the child is born, or for that matter, even when the fetus starts living as a separate being, right? Even when the mother is pregnant, you start sensing that there is another being inside me. The separation has already occurred. The individuality is already born. But along with the birth of the child or birth of that individuality, the mother is also born. Till the child comes into the picture, the woman is not a mother. Motherhood is also born only with the child, isn't it? In the same manner, even when para prakriti is born, even when you're talking about para prakriti and apara prakriti, para prakriti is born with apara prakriti. Apara prakriti is like the individuality of creation, and along with individuality of creation, now that same divine is referred to as para prakriti. As Krishna said, para prakriti is changeless. It does not undergo any modification. It is endless. It is without a beginning, without an end. And unlike jagat, the world, it doesn't come and go. But when this apara prakriti is born, then this concept of para prakriti is born along with it. Just like how when the child is born, motherhood is born along with it. Till then, there is only one. So there was only one. Through Maya, a prakriti was created, which is what we refer to as Swabhava of God. But the Swarupa, the real nature of God, never changed. But that unchanged aspect is now referred to as para prakriti, because you are defining it with reference to the apara prakriti which is born. Like the same person, after giving birth, is now called a mother. But where does this analogy become limited? The analogy of a mother and a child. The mother, thankfully, doesn't consume the child in the end, isn't it? In fact, with time, the child becomes more and more independent and more distinct and individual in its characteristics. But the analogy is useful to understand that when God says, I created two prakritis, it is not that God plus para prakriti plus apara prakriti leading to three entities. What actually happens is God creates only prakriti, which is apara prakriti, and because apara prakriti becomes an entity, Now this same changeless divine Swarupa is now given the name Paraprakriti. So this is one of the confusions I spoke of in the beginning when I said when Krishna says para and apara, it seems like there is God and then there are two Prakritis. It is not like that. There is God, there is Prakriti, and this Prakriti is as much infused with divinity as that Supreme itself, but there are some different, there are slightly different characteristics which we will talk about even in the discussion to follow and the shlokas to follow. So that is one analogy that I said is limited, at the same time conveys a certain idea. The other analogy that is slightly better in a sense than the mother and the child is the idea of waves and the ocean, which we discussed when we were discussing the shloka of the second chapter that I quoted just a while ago. There is the ocean, and for a very brief time, the waves are formed from the ocean itself, and even before you can recognize it, the wave merges back into the ocean, which is very similar to what Krishna says. So it can well be said that the vyaktitva, the individuality, was only a brief illusion. The wave does not have an existence of its own, because it rises and it falls, and in reference to the life of the ocean itself, that existence is so brief that you can say that vyaktitva, that individuality, was not there at all, right? And that is why we use the word mithya in Vedanta. It appears real, but it isn't, because it is anitya. It is not constant. It is ephemeral by nature. But let me present the problem with this analogy. Why is this not a perfect analogy? If the wave is the same as the ocean, the question comes, what does it matter if I choose the wave or the ocean? If apara prakriti, this material world, has also come from God, why can't I go after the world? And why can't I be a worldly person? Why are you telling me to go only after the para prakriti or divinity? So this is where I'm not sure how clearly I will be able to explain this, but let us see. And I will try to do it with the least complicated terminology as possible, because when I was trying to read this, there are a lot more words. If you think that I'm using too many Sanskrit words and complicated Vedantic terminology, let me assure you I'm using probably 1/5 of what is used to explain this concept. Now let's see how this fits in and how do we comprehend and wrap our mind around this. The truth is, no change takes place at all. When you say the para prakriti, which is the true Swarupa of God, undergoes no change whatsoever, because that is one of the characteristics of the para prakriti, that it is changeless. When we say that it is changeless, then the idea that a part of it changes to become prakriti or apara prakriti seems to be meaningless. So the truth is, it actually does not happen at all. That is why we use it. We say that it is a play of Maya. The creation in reality doesn't happen at all. That is why the separate existence is itself an illusion. What is the Swarupa of God? What is the nature, the true nature of God? There are three words which are used to describe this nature of God, and which is Satyam, Jnanam, Anantam. We've heard Swami also speak extensively about this in his discourses. Satyam, Jnanam, Anantam, Brahma. That's the complete statement, which means this Brahman that we're talking about is Satyam, which means it is truth. It is constant in all times. Trikala Badhyam Satyam, Swami would say. So it is Satyam, which means it is eternal. It is changeless in all times. Jnanam, it is knowledge. When we say it is jnanam, it does not mean it contains all knowledge. It is it is because of this that you know anything. Right? It is because of this that anything can be known. So, satyam, jnanam, anantam. It is endless. It is ceaseless. It does not have a break. It is not like from this point you have Brahman and then there is a break and then the Brahman continues. No, it is akhanda. It is ananta. It does not have any break in between. Truly speaking, we speak of this satyam, jnanam, anantam nature of divinity only because there is something which is not satyam, not jnanam and not anantam, isn't it? Otherwise, divinity is only divinity. We will not use these words to describe it at all. Because there is something which is ephemeral, we are referring to divine as being constant. Because there is something which is jada, we are looking at God and saying, this is jnanam, this is consciousness. Because something is limited, we are defining divinity as being unlimited, anantam. Through maya or illusion, a world is created which does not have these properties of satyam, jnanam and anantam. When will we realize that the world does not have these properties? When we begin to analyze it. And when we analyze, we come to this understanding that our own nature is the same as this para prakriti. Our own nature is satyam, jnanam, anantam. And it is not the nature of the apara prakriti. So everything is a change that occurs only in our perception. The world does not collapse the moment knowledge comes into this mind. The world remains, but in my mind everything changes. Right? So everything is only a transformation or a change in perception. It is not like putting two plates of sweets in front of me and saying I can choose any, because both are made of sugar. Right? That is the flaw I told you about, the example of the wave and the ocean. If both have the same nature, why can't I choose the wave over the ocean? Why can't I choose the world over God? So it is not like two plates of sweets put in front of me. Both are made of sugar. What does it matter which one I choose? When we are talking about para prakriti and apara prakriti, if I choose one plate, I choose not to know the oneness. When I choose the other plate, I choose to understand the oneness. And that is why the choice makes it very, very different. Right? The same Lord is para and apara prakriti. But if the vyakti or individual goes after the world, the apara prakriti, then the vyaktitva or individuality will be further strengthened or deepened. That is something that you don't want. That is the opposite of what we are trying to reach on the spiritual path. But if the vyakti turns to God, then the vyaktitva will be sublimated and one will be able to see the truth that Krishna is trying to explain. I'll repeat that statement again. So in front of us there is para prakriti and apara prakriti. Yes, essentially both are divine, but in choosing apara prakriti, when the vyakti or the individual chooses apara prakriti, this vyaktitva gets deepened. One is further into the idea that I am a separate individual. But when the vyakti turns to para prakriti, the vyaktitva now begins to get sublimated and the oneness is now seen. Because this whole idea of oneness and multiplicity is only in perception. So when Krishna says, Yetat yonini bhutani sarvani iti upadharaya. It can be seen as Krishna explaining, understand, O Arjuna, that all that exists have come from these two prakritis. But this statement can also be seen as, understand this, O Arjuna, this is a command. And how will you understand that? How will you understand that all of this has come from the same Lord? That understanding will dawn on the individual only when the individual chooses to go after para prakriti and not the apara prakriti. So it can be seen as a command also from Krishna or an explanation also from Krishna. So that is why I said there is a confusion when Krishna says that this is para prakriti, this is apara prakriti, and both have come from me, both are equally divine. Then why should I sit and listen to Gita series, and I might as well go and see a movie and chill out, right? But that is the difference. If you want to believe and if you want to enjoy the bliss of oneness, you will have to choose one over the other. And this is going to be further explained in very beautiful ways in the next few shlokas and the next few chapters too. So this is, if you have not understood it and if you're not convinced about it, it really doesn't matter. Because if this can be grasped over a lecture, and if it can be grasped from the words of the avatar, be sure by now I should have been self-realized, having heard so many discourses from Swami, and I'm sure many of you listeners also will agree with me. So many of you have heard so many discourses from Swami. It does not come only through Shravanam. It comes through Shravanam, Mananam and Nididhyasanam. So in the program, we endeavor to keep listening more and more and more. And the more we listen, the more we will contemplate. And the more we contemplate, the more it will percolate into our understanding and our perception. We'll go to the next shloka, the seventh shloka, where this discourse continues. Another beautiful analogy is introduced by Krishna in this shloka, which is also very valuable, and we'll listen to that and we'll discuss about that after listening to it.
Mattah parataram nanyat kinchidasti dhananjaya mayi sarvamidam protam Sutre Manigana Iva.
O Dhananjaya, there is nothing else whatsoever higher than myself. All this is strung on me like pearls on a string. That's the beautiful seventh verse of the seventh chapter. When Krishna says, the entire creation came from me and will dissolve in me, it is like clay and the different pots that are made with that same clay. Again, I'm giving you another analogy, and this analogy too is a classic Upanishadic Vedantic analogy. All pots, however different in shape and size, you might call it something, you might call something a water pot, you might call something as a cooking pot. You may give it different names. It can have different forms, sizes, colors, but all have come from the same clay. And at some point in time, they will all return to that state of clay. But when you speak about clay and pot, then you introduce the idea of a potter. A potter takes clay and converts it into pot. So when you talk about para prakriti and apara prakriti, and you say apara prakriti becomes this entire creation, the question comes, is there someone who's higher than this para prakriti and apara prakriti, who is using these two to create these things? Of course, in the explanation that I gave you before, I explained that it is not that God creates these two, para and apara. But Krishna clarifies that in the shloka by saying that it is not so. He says, Mattah parataram, higher than me, anyat kinchit, anyone other, na asti Dhananjaya, there is none, O Dhananjaya. Other than me, anyat kinchit, there is no other higher than me, parataram. So there is no creator or source beyond Krishna, beyond para prakriti. The creation comes from him, and he says, returns unto him. And this is the point we discussed before I played the shloka as well. There is no three, there is only two, and even the two dissolves into one when studied closely. As you can see, we are repeatedly using multiple analogies. because this is not akin to anything that we experience in this world. Nothing that we undergo or see or read about or experience in this world is anywhere close to the concepts that are being spoken of here, right? That's why it is called para. It is something other than what you already know. But through these analogies and examples, you can get glimpses of understanding of what it really is. In fact, the relationship between Swabhava and Swarupa itself is supposed to be like that. Studying nature or Prakriti, to a certain extent you can understand God. But Para Prakriti is not a Para Prakriti, and the only way you can completely understand it is when you become that. It is like saying, see the moon. They point out to the moon and say, see the moon. And you ask, where is the moon? Oh, it is just beyond that branch. Do you see that branch of the tree? It is just above that branch. The truth is, the branch is somewhere, the moon is somewhere. But that information of see the moon, which is just above the branch, is good enough for you to see the moon, right? Similarly, though the para prakriti and apara prakriti are so different by nature, by studying apara prakriti in depth, one can still have an opportunity to look at para prakriti, the true swarupa of God, directly. And since no analogy is complete, Krishna gives one more analogy in this particular shloka, which comes in the very next line. He says, sutre manigana iva, like different pearls or different beads strung together by a string. Mayi, in me, sarvamidam, all this, protam, is strung. This is another classic Vedantic example, which we have heard many, many times from Swami also. In many discourses, Swami speaks of this. He says, God is like the string that connects all. And more importantly, Swami would say, when you see a garland of flowers, a garland of pearls, you may not be able to see the string. But the very fact that there is a garland is itself a proof that there is a string. Like that, though God cannot be seen, the very fact that the world is what it is, the way it is functioning, the way there is life, the way it is being vibrant and active, that itself is a sign that there is God. And that is why Swami would use that beautiful analogy of string and beads and string and garland. There are two ways of looking at this particular declaration of Krishna. One is, Krishna is stating that I am in each person. If you consider each bead or money as an individual, that string that holds that person is God. Right? The Jivatma, as Krishna said, is God. The other way of looking at it is, consider the smallest component of creation. For the sake of argument, let's say atom. I know that atom is not the smallest building block, so physicists don't pounce on me. Just for the argument's sake, let's say atom is the smallest block of creation. Do you know how many atoms are there in an average human body? I'm sure you don't. Even I did not know, so I googled it and I've got the numbers here. If I were to believe the calculations given in that particular website, in a person who weighs about 70 kgs, there are 7 followed by 27 zeros atoms. In other words, there are 7 billion, billion, billion atoms in each body. On an average, 70 kgs, right? Such a huge number that it takes time even to wrap our mind around it, isn't it? How did these many atoms become this individual that I call by a name, Prem? Because left alone, they all are insentient matter, isn't it? They don't have life of their own. They're just material. How is it that these many atoms, 7 billion, billion, billion atoms have come together and have formed this human being? What is it that holds all of them together and makes them function as an individual? I think I mentioned this earlier too. I was reading this somewhere. There are many, many microbes in our guts, right, which help us digest our food. They are not human cells, but they are microbes that are actually like parasites. They're not parasites, more symbiotic relationship with the human body. So they are living in the guts and they help us in digesting the food that we eat. When the person dies, the same microbes help in decomposing the body, which means the same microbes now begin to eat the body. How remarkable this is. There is some force inside this body which makes even these microbes behave. The moment this force leaves, the whole body starts crumbling. The same microbes start consuming this body. So there is some force that ensures that when you put something into the mouth, it converts that food into this body. So when Krishna says, Mayi sarvamidam protam sutre manigana iva, manigana iva, it could mean that he, as the jiva inside the body, strings all these billions and billions and billions of atoms together and holds them to behave as an individual. The moment that the string is removed, what happens to the pearl necklace if the string gets cut? All the pearls scatter. And a very similar thing happens even to this body. The moment this sutra, the string, is removed from this body, the atoms scatter and go back into their elements. But as I said, the statement can also be seen as this entire creation being held together as God, as the string within. And it is from this word sutra that we have the name sutradhari. The sutradhari is the one who is holding the string. Of course, there's another analogy. If you look at the whole world as a stage and all beings as puppets, then the Lord is described as sutradhari, the one who is holding the strings. And we very beautifully extol the Lord in the bhajan. We say that he is Maya Nataka Sutradhari, Maya Manusha Veshadhari. He is the unseen string puller in this drama of Maya, but once in a while he also wears the garb of a human being and comes into this world. Maya Nataka Sutradhari, Maya Manusha Veshadhari. In the next few shlokas, Krishna explains beautifully in what attributes of this world you can find him. As I said last week, the nature of apara prakriti is that it is constantly changing. It moves, it transforms further and further and moves further and further away from the swarupa of God. What begins as the quality of love ends up as the quality of attachment. What begins as the pure quality of strength becomes arrogance. What starts as the beautiful quality of beauty becomes pride and hubris. So Krishna is going to point out all those qualities, all those attributes that represent him in this apara prakriti. And some of them are the qualities that give uniqueness or individuality to some of these entities, but some of them are the purest aspects of those individual entities as well. Anyway, we will see some of these examples are going to continue in the next 3 or 4 or 5 shlokas, but we'll have time only for the next shloka. But there are some very beautiful and profound points that Krishna is making. So we'll listen to the 8th shloka. I'll give you a brief meaning of that. And we'll try to discuss as much as time permits us to.
Rasohamapsu Kaunteya Prabhasmi Shashi Suryayo Pranavas Sarva Vedeshu Shabdakhe Paurusham Drushu.
O son of Kunti, I am the taste of water. I am the effulgence of the moon and the sun. Om in all the Vedas, the sound in space and virility in men. So that's the eighth shloka and the first shloka where Krishna speaks of how can the swarupa be discovered in the swabhava, in what qualities, in what attributes. In this shloka, Krishna mentions a few elements and of course a few other entities as well, and mentions those attributes that make them what they are, gives them their individuality, and says, know that I am present in these elements as these qualities. Much later, I think in the 10th chapter, Krishna is again going to speak about a very similar tone where he says, among rishis, I am so-and-so, among the devas, I am so-and-so, among demons, I am so-and-so. The format is pretty similar, and of course the idea that Krishna is conveying there might be slightly different, but Krishna mentions here some things in a very similar tone. He says, the first thing he says is, apsu, in water, rasaha, rasaha aham, I am rasa. The word rasa has two different meanings. One is the essence and the other is taste. The famous line from Taittiriya Upanishad again, which Swami would often quote in his discourses, goes, raso vai saha. God is the rasa in this world. Meaning, it is because of God, it is because God is the essence of this world, we are able to experience bliss and enjoy this world. And the one who attains God is constantly in bliss. And that's the verse from Taittiriya Upanishad which says Raso Vai Saha and the subsequent line. But here rasa is used in a very specific meaning. It is used to mean taste. When Krishna says apaha or water, we can say that it is a reference to the tanmatra water, the subtle element of water, and the water element, the gross element as well. When water tanmatra is created in the process which we refer to, which I made a passing reference to, I did not go into the detail, where Swami speaks about how from the absolute, the akasha, the vayu and all of them, the elements come, and eventually the panchikritam process happens and you have the gross elements being formed. When the tanmatra of water is created, along with it, the jnanendriya of rasa is also created. When each of the element is created, in those descriptions it is said that an associated quality also is created. When akasha was created, shabda or sound, or the ability to hear was created, which Krishna mentions in this shloka itself. Probably I'll take those verses, those words also. He says, shabdaha, I am sound, khe, in ether. So the description goes that when akasha was created, along with akasha, shabda was created. With vayu, sparsha, or the faculty of touch was created. With agni, rupa, or the faculty of sight, with apa, or water, the faculty of taste, and with prithvi, the faculty of smell. That is why, along with the five tanmatras, the faculties of shabda, sparsha, rupa, rasa, and gandha were also created. And even when we look at the five gross elements, space is sensed by sound. The only way you can sense space is sound, right? The classic example of that is how you have your animals, mammals like bats and dolphins. How do they navigate through their environs? It's because they're able to sense distance or sense space through sound. So shabda has the quality of sound. And when we come to vayu, when there is a breeze, there is sound and it can also be felt. When we say fire, there is sound, it can be felt, but now, for the first time, it can also be seen. Similarly, when we talk about water, it can be heard, it can be seen, it can be felt, but now it can also be tasted. So rasa, or taste, is the quality that makes water stand out from the other elements. Similarly, sound is the quality that defines space or ether. So Krishna says, rasaha, rasaha, aham, apsu. In water, I am the taste. Shabdaha, khe. In ether, I am the attribute of sound. Of course, this Krishna says in the second line, I'm just grouping them together because they both are talking about elements. Next Krishna says, prabha asmi. I am the light. Shashi surya yoho. In the moon and the sun. Again, the reason why we adore these entities in the sky is light. And Krishna says, I am the light. Another way of looking at it is, as Swami would say, we see the sun. We are able to see the sun because of the sun's own light. We see the moon. We are able to see the moon because of moonlight. Of course, you will say that it's the same sunlight which is being reflected. I'm not denying that. So when Krishna says, I am the light of the sun and the moon, that's what it means. One is that he is the brilliance of these celestial bodies. The other idea is, anything in the world that we are able to see or experience, we experience it because of him. That is one more way of understanding this. Because the idea is, you see the sun through the sunlight and the moon through the moonlight. When Krishna says, I am the light, prabha asmi, it means we are able to experience this because of the divinity being present in it. Then Krishna makes two more such statements in the shloka. He says, pranavaha sarva vedeshu. I am pranava, or om in the Vedas. Paurusham nrishu. I am virility or strength in man. We'll come to the pranava a little shortly. We'll conclude with that. First, we'll complete the statement in the shloka where he says, paurusham nrishu. Again, Krishna refers to a defining quality. Paurusham is a word that can again have multiple meanings. So is this word nara, nrishu. It means it comes from the word nara. In a very general sense, the word nara can be used for all human beings. Like when Swami says nara seva is narayana seva, he is not referring to gender nara. Nara also means man. Swami is not saying if you go and serve the male gender, you're serving Narayana. No, Swami says Naraseva means serving people in general is service to God. So if we take that meaning, Nara meaning all human beings, then Paurusham literally means life, power, vibrancy, right? So which when is absent, we no more refer to the human body with a title. We refer to it as it. It has become a corpse, right? So when Krishna says, I am Paurusham in the Nara, it means I am the liveliness in men or in human beings. Or we can say Paurusham as virility, right? Or manliness. So Krishna is saying, I am the manliness in man. If you take Nara to be the gender male. So Paurusham Nrishu, I am the manliness in man. This also conveys the idea that Krishna is putting forth. I am everything. I am also that which makes an entity stand out from the rest. I am also that by which you recognize the entity as being unique or being different from the other entities in the world. Coming back to this other wonderful, profound statement. Pranavaha sarva vedeshu. I am Pranava, the Vedas. I am Pranava or Omkara in the Vedas, Krishna says. I think there is so much that can be spoken about Pranava. Vedanta considers this Pranava, this one alphabet, Om, to be the most sacred of all sounds. In the next chapter, Krishna refers to it as Om iti ekaksharam Brahma. The next chapter, the statement comes, Om iti ekaksharam Brahma. Om is the one-syllabled representation of divinity. This entire divine aspect is represented by Om. Another way of, if I have to explain the glory of the statement that Krishna is making, we all know that Adi Shankara has written commentaries on a few standout Upanishads. Swami writes in his Upanishad Vahini that originally there were about 1,180 Upanishads. And of this 1,180, only 108 Upanishads survived. And of those 108 Upanishads, 10 are given special importance because these 10 have been studied and written and widely acclaimed because of the commentary that Adi Shankara wrote for them. These Upanishads, they are themselves supposed to be the essence of Vedas. The Vedas are all knowledge. The essence of the Vedas are the Upanishads. And of the 1,180 Upanishads, only 10 are being held up. Even Swami's Upanishad Vahini has commentaries for these 10 Upanishads, I think, if I'm not wrong. Apparently, Adi Shankara would write, has written, I don't know where exactly, but this is what it is said. Adi Shankara says, if you cannot read all the Upanishads, and if you have time and interest only to read one Upanishad, Adi Shankara says, read the Mandukya Upanishad. One of the reasons is it is one of the shortest Upanishads. Of course, that is not the reason why Adi Shankara says, go read the Mandukya Upanishad. The reason why he holds Mandukya Upanishad among these 1,180 Upanishads as being very special is much of the Mandukya Upanishad speaks about the glory of Pranava or Omkara. The most important sound in the Vedas is spoken of as Pranava. So it is the essence of the essence of the essence. That is why Krishna says, Pranavaha Sarva Vedeshu. I am Pranava in the world. Generally, what is very scarce is considered to be most precious, isn't it? That's how we treat something, that's how we give value to things. Why is gold and diamond precious? Because there's only a limited reserve of that in this world, and every ounce of that becomes very, very precious. Same is the case with some rare fruits or rare herbs. What is limited becomes exclusive, and what is limited and exclusive becomes more valuable. But Pranava is very interesting. Pranava is a sound which is most ubiquitous. Swami says Pranava is everywhere. Just close your ears and you will hear Pranava. Go to a stump of a tree or a stump of an electric pole, put your ear to it, you will hear the Pranava. You find a conch in a beach, take it and put it to your ear, you will hear Pranava. Swami says Pranava is everywhere. Even when you are in absolute silence, Swami says you can hear Pranava. Pranava is everywhere, but yet it is the most precious. That's what probably makes it so unique, isn't it? And Krishna says, in the Vedas, I am the Pranava. There was another very beautiful story, a couple of stories that I kept about Pranava that I thought I'll narrate, but I think I'm running out of time. Don't worry, you're not going anywhere. I'm not going anywhere. Next week when we start, I'll start with these two beautiful stories which speak about the importance of Pranava, especially this aspect which I just said, that it is found everywhere, but yet it is so precious. We'll begin with that story next week. So hopefully that's one reason why you'll come back to me next week and tune into the Gita series, The Triune Pilgrimage. Nevertheless, I'm very grateful to all of you for your company week after week. And I most humbly offer this effort at Bhagwan's lotus feet. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the next segment and the last segment of today's Thursday Live, the Vahini Satsang. Till I meet you all next week, take care, keep safe. Jai Sainam.